Iran says it will not cooperate with a so-called fact-finding mission set up by the UN Human Rights Council to investigate the recent incidents in the country. Nearly 200 Palestinian and international organizations calling an international criminal court to investigate Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. Now, Russia denies reports that its forces are planning to leave the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in Ukraine. Hello everyone, welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behzad Rezanjani. Good to have you with us. Iran has dismissed a move by the UN Human Rights Council to establish a fact-finding mission on the recent riots in the country. The foreign ministry spokesman says that Tehran says that such an approach undermines the legitimacy of UN mechanisms. Kanani also lashed out at Germany for co-sponsoring an anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based council. He said that Germany is the same country that supplied chemical weaponry to the former Iraqi regime during the 1980s war against Iran.
As confirmed by the different exhibits and numerous reports of the German authorities and fact-finding committees of the United Nations, the companies of this country have been among main suppliers of chemical material and weapons to the aggressor regime in Iraq in its war on Iran, with the knowledge of the German government and despite warnings by the United Nations. The statistics that is available shows the Ba'athist regime in Iraq conducted 572 chemical attacks on Iran, 165 times with artillery, 79 times with shells, and 14 times with choppers. Those affected include 10,000 martyrs, some 100,000 injured, and 67,000 of them living war veterans.
Now, the Iranian Foreign Ministry also summoned the German ambassador to lodge a strong protest over Berlin's support for the anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based UN body. The ministry also slammed the recent comments made by German officials on the situation in Iran, calling them baseless and meddlesome. Now, we've spoken to author and commentator John Stepling for his take on the recent anti-Iran resolution by UN Human Rights Council and Tehran's reaction.
I think there's no reason at all for Iran to participate on any level with this, because it only serves to at least partly legitimize the process, and it's an illegitimate project. Iran has nothing to gain. I think they should sever all ties with the United States, I mean diplomatic ties, because I don't see the good that can come out of it at this point. The U.S. has sanctioned Iran. These are criminal sanctions. The United States sanctions almost everybody, but they have illegally sanctioned Iran. Iran agreed to the JCPOA, bent over backwards to meet all its requirements, and the United States tore it up anyway. The U.S. is very big on tearing up treaties and international agreements. Iran has done none of that, and yet they are constantly the object of this rhetorical abuse from the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, European media. It's unbelievably biased, and it's very hard, I think, for the Western public to get an accurate picture of the situation vis-a-vis Iran, because much as it is impossible for Western public to get a picture of Russia, because the reporting is so extraordinarily biased and one-sided.
Now, on the occasion of Basij Week, Iran's leader has addressed members of the volunteer force. Basij is affiliated to IRGC, has been at the forefront of confronting rioters in Iran. In his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei said that negotiating with the United States won't resolve anything, stressing that Iran's main confrontation is against the global hegemony, not a bunch of rioters.
It was an important forum, comprised of volunteer forces that have been at the forefront in confronting the rioters. the all-too-important besieged force, which throughout the decades have not only served in the security arena, have contributed to Iran's advancements in a host of fields like science and technology. Iran's leader, in his address to them for the occasion of Besiege Week, said that these forces have sacrificed themselves in order to save people from a bunch of rioters and mercenaries. But he also advised them on who the real enemy is, that in the bigger picture, Iran's battle is not with a group of rioters, but with global hegemony. The onslaught on Iran, especially through the media, has been organized by foreign actors, like from Saudi Arabia and the UK. With US and Israel aiding and abetting their fake news, the primary goal has been to create unrest inside of Iran by inviting Iranians to come out and protest. At the same time, there are some under the misguided belief that talking to the U.S. will solve Iran's problems.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
But Iran's leader has said that negotiating will not resolve anything, saying that our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom.
Iran has held several rounds of talks with the West over its civility and nuclear program, but negotiations have not yielded the results that Tehran wants. The main reason has been Washington's excessive demands and unwillingness to compromise. The U.S. wants to strip Iran of all its capabilities. That includes its nuclear knowledge and defense capability, like missiles.
There have been lots of speculations as to why the riots began in the first place, especially the timing, which came when the JCPOA sanctions removal talks with world powers were deadlocked over Washington's lack of commitment. It is a distinct possibility that the recent riots may have been part of the West's pressure on Iran to compromise on its rights in negotiations, including with the U.S. Yet the whole notion on continuing with these talks is not in the best interest of Iran and can never bear fruit due to the West and U.S.'s excessive demands. Realistically, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, to change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside of its borders, and to close its defense industries, basically stripping the country of its identity. Some of these restrictions and excessive demands are due to Israel, which acts in line with U.S. policies to maintain dominance over the region. After all, the U.S. has worked hard to vilify Iran through Iranophobia in the region, pushing Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel to unite against regional power, Iran. That is one of the reasons that Iran has time and again said that the U.S. must leave the West Asia region as it only seeks to weaken and ultimately disintegrate Muslim countries, as stated by advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati. The U.S. has played a destructive role in the region, like pushing hard for the partitioning of Iraq and Syria, trying to do the same with Iran. This has been a goal of the U.S., a West Asia region whose borders can be redrawn to their liking, with the ultimate goal of having vassal states serving U.S. interests. But when it comes to Iran, that will be an impossible feat. One only has to look at the most recent showing of Iranians when it came to their large-scale presence earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, and for the funeral of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, whom the U.S. assassinated back in 2020 from a drone strike in Baghdad. Not to mention the funeral processions which Iranians participated in the funerals held in Karaj, Isfahan, and Shiraz.
The nearly 200 Palestinian international bodies have called on the International Criminal Court to investigate Israel's acts of aggression against Palestinians. The NGOs say that a probe should cover crimes committed by Tel Aviv during its war on Gaza last August. They said that the regime is engaged in war crimes and crimes against humanity, including crime of apartheid against Palestinians. They're calling for appropriate measures to prevent such crimes. The organization has also slammed Israel's move to label Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorists. They called for public condemnation of such measures. Palestinians have witnessed a sharp increase in Israeli attacks. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians this year, almost a quarter of them children. An international conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to highlight the Israeli blockade and its dire consequences on the Palestinians. The Israeli regime has kept the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more in his report.
Hamas's Council on International Relations has held an international conference on the impact of the Israeli blockade. The event aims to shed light on the crippling Israeli blockade on more than 2 million Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip. The event was attended by figures representing the Gaza Government Committee and civil society organizations. They discussed ways to tackle the repercussions of the blockade. Living conditions and the standard of living in the Gaza Strip have been rapidly deteriorating under the Israeli blockade. The Hamas movement says Western countries, mainly the United States, are supporting the Israeli blockade.
The Israeli siege, unfortunately supported by the international community, mainly the Americans, have converted Gaza into the biggest open-air prison on earth. We can see the catastrophic impacts of this siege in every corner here in the Gaza Strip, which can develop up to a crime against humanity or an ethnic cleansing.
Speakers via video conference included Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Palestine, as well as Richard Falk, the chairman of the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor. Statistics show that most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive because of the blockade.
More than 2 million Palestinians, most of them children, women, elders, and patients, are suffering from this catastrophic condition due to the continuous blockade for more than 15 years. The international community's silence leads to continue such offensive on Palestinians.
Unemployment and poverty rates have skyrocketed under the blockade. At the conference, attendees called for the immediate lifting of the inhumane siege.
This is a call to the world to stop its a silence over what's been going on the Gaza Strip, and to urge all governments of the world in Europe and the United States and other parties around the world to intervene actively to end this illegal and punishing siege on the Gaza Strip population.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Gaza Strip is already devastated by the Israeli blockade and is edging closer to breaking point. The prolonged blockade has undermined all aspects of life in the Gaza Strip since 2007. Experts say the inhumane Israeli practices have deprived Palestinians of their rights. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Russia rejecting allegations that its forces are planning to leave the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in southern Ukraine. A senior Ukrainian official has said that there were signs that Russian forces were preparing to leave the complex. The Kremlin has denied any such move. It says that the plant will remain under Russia's control. Russia seized the plant just weeks after it launched a military offensive in Ukraine. The area has come under repeated shelling, with each side blaming the other. Last week, Moscow accused Ukrainian forces of continued shelling of the plant, warning it could lead to a nuclear disaster. A series of strikes has caused widespread damage to Europe's biggest nuclear power plant. Meantime, the UN Nuclear Agency has called for the creation of a safe zone around the complex. Morocco's FIFA World Cup win against Belgium has triggered clashes, and that after a Moroccan community burst into celebrations in the Belgian capital, Brussels. Dozens of fans smashed store windows, threw fireworks, and set fire vehicles. Around 100 officers used tear gas and water cannon to disperse the rioters. 11 people were reportedly arrested. Also in the eastern city of Liège, a gang of 50 people attacked a police station, breaking windows and damaging two of their cars. Police there also resorted to water cannon. Belgium is home to around 500,000 people of Moroccan descent. Morocco beat Belgium 2-0 in the World Cup face-off. In Austria, railway workers have staged a day-long strike over pay, bringing trains to a standstill and creating travel chaos across the country. The strike has impacted some 8,000 connections and some 1 million passengers. The 24-hour walkout followed the failure of a fifth round of negotiations between the government and the union. The main rail workers' union is calling for a $417 monthly pay rise for 50,000 employees. The union has warned about more industrial actions. Authorities say the services would be more or less back to normal by the following day. Austria is an important hub for rail travel in Europe, connecting 8 countries, including Italy, Germany, Switzerland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. The death toll from a landslide in Italy's southern island of Ischia has risen to 8 as rescuers are searching for 4 people who remain missing. A newborn baby and 2 kids were among the 8 people killed. The government has declared a state of emergency. Dozens of workers have rushed the flood-hit island. A wave of debris and stones broke away from the island's highest mountain and swept through a small town early Saturday. Aerial footage shows the destruction of buildings and cars pushed into the sea. Ischia is a densely populated volcanic island which lies some 30 kilometers from Naples. November 28th marks the 3rd anniversary of a U.S. deadly drone strike on a civilian car in Afghanistan. It killed all 5 people in the car, including 3 women. A correspondent has a report.
Back on November 28th, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left 5 people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, 3 of her relatives, and the driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of victims, remembered the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable.
The targeted people were members of my uncle's family. They were martyred cruelly and horrifically. After giving birth to her son, my aunt's situation worsened. Then they left for the hospital together with my cousins. When returning from the hospital, their car was bombed by a U.S. drone strike. In total, 3 women, a boy called Nurajan, and the driver, Mohammed Nabi, were martyred.
The U.S. crimes in Afghanistan are unforgivable. In fact, the U.S. government supported and empowered terrorists on our land and hurt civilians and innocent people. Now, as facts are surfacing, we understand that the U.S. war on terror was a game and a pretext to justify America's presence in the region.
Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. to account for civilian victims of its airstrikes.
We have proof that the U.S. and its allies committed war crimes in Afghanistan. During their night raids, mass bombardments, and land missions, many innocent people were killed and their properties were damaged. The 2019 U.S. drone attack in Khost is one of many instances. Today, the families of victims are calling for investigations into such unlawful killings and compensation for their losses.
According to verified reports, throughout the 2-decade U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. occupation of their country. They call for justice for American forces' atrocities on their soil. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
under the starry sky of the desert. From the very heart of evergreen forests. With the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains. Closer. Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Yes, pass the ball! I hope Iran wins. Hey, we scored a goal! Thank you, guys!
ایران دو ورز سفر ما باید برمیگشتیم به اینجا و برگشتیم گل دوم به نام رامین
Hello. رزاد I'm watching the game. Did you see the goal? Iran was great. What's up?
نخواهند کرد
Oh, rafting? Where? In Haraz River? On Thursday? Okay, good idea. Bye-bye. Iran has unique characteristics due to its geographical location. Two mountain ranges, namely Zagros in the west and Alborz in the north, have created permanent large rivers on the Iranian plateau. The Alborz mountain range in the south of the Caspian Sea, with Damavand Peak, has created the northern rivers of Iran, such as Haraz and Chalus, which are great places for water sports as well as rafting. The Zagros mountain range extends from northwest to southern Iran. This mountain range is home to the oldest Iranian ethnicities. It creates the most beautiful natural scenery and has also gifted the largest rivers to the people. Due to these features, Iran is one of the best countries for rafting. If you are looking for adventures during your trip to Iran, rafting in Iran is one of the best available options. In addition to all the tourist activities, rafting in Iran gives you the opportunity to have a real thrill. It is one of the most popular water sports in Iran. The months of April, May, and June are considered the best times to participate in rafting in Iran. ¶¶
I am now beside Harrah's River. It's very interesting that this river stretches from Damavand Peak to the Caspian Sea. It's a very long river. So here we are for rafting. Rafting is a highly dynamic activity that is always unique. When people hear about rafting, they mostly imagine powerful rapids, dangerous environments, and adrenaline rush. Well, let me get prepared for the job. This sport has a special outfit.
Hey guys, listen carefully. There are some points about this sport which you have to take into consideration. Follow the rules during the journey. No pause on the way, just left or right, as I say. Whitewater rafting can be a dangerous sport, especially if basic safety precautions are not observed, so be very careful.
In case we fell down in the water, we have life jackets, so I feel confident and have no fear.
No question? So zip up your life jacket and sit down in your rafting boat. Ready? 1, 2, 3, go!
Try this sport once in your life, especially in Iranian Whitewater River.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
I'll tell you, you know, this discussion on ignorance in Islamic ethics is a very beautiful one. Right? Jahl basit, jahl murakkab. You've heard it several times, I'm sure. There are two types of ignorances, right? One is simple ignorance, one is compound ignorance. Simple ignorance is that, look, I'm not a surgeon. You're asking me to perform open heart surgery? I can't do it. I don't have that knowledge. That's very simple ignorance. I can't change brakes. I can't do your taxes. Right? I don't have the knowledge. I can't grow veggies in my garden. I can't do it. I don't have the knowledge. That's jahl basit, fine. Jahl murakkab is a very dangerous type of ignorance. It's compound, meaning what? There's something else with it. It's ignorance with an ego. It's a person who's ignorant, but doesn't know he's ignorant. Oh, I love those people. The debates they have with people like me. Oof. When Imam Ali describes them as somebody who doesn't know and they don't know that they don't know. Oh. And that's why he says the phrase, I don't know, is pur barakat, he says, filled with barakat. The moment that you say, I don't know, the path for knowledge is laid out. And the barakat of ilm. But you have to swallow your ego and say, you know what, I don't know, I'll get back to you. It's very hard. Especially if somebody in front of you expects you to have the answer. You don't know? No, I don't know. What'd you do all those years in home? Why don't you know? I don't know. So we don't want to be those individuals who are somebody who thinks that I know this, I know that, I know Allah is one, I know Allah is one, I don't need to know. Let's remove that ego. And let's begin now to humble ourselves in front of the knowledge. I mentioned Nabi Ibrahim, right? The idea that, look, he turns to Allah, Allah, I want to know. I want to know how you bring the dead back to life. That's him searching knowledge, seeking knowledge. There comes a moment late in Nabi Musa's life where he's sitting there in the desert now, surrounded by his companions, and they say to Nabi Musa, I don't think there's a man alive who is more knowledgeable than you. Now, albeit an infallible prophet, but still an insan, and he's very concerned, Nabi Musa, the books say, about this ego now. Right? If someone says that to you, that, oh, I think you're the smartest guy out there, you're bound to feel like, well, either you embrace that, or you try to push it down. So he turns to God and says, Allah, please, look at Nabi Musa. I love Nabi Musa, alayhi salam. He says, find me someone on this earth who's more knowledgeable than me. And then, connect us to. So the story of Khizr, of course, as many of you know. Go find this prophet named Khizr there. He's somebody who knows more than you, Musa. The prophet of God, can you imagine? Meaning what? The process of knowledge never ends. I'm building towards my content, don't worry. There's a hadith called the hadith of Unwan al-Basri. Unwan al-Basri was a man during the time of Imam Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam. Allahumma salli ala. Very, very quickly, he was a student of Malik ibn Anas during the time of Imam Sadiq, but he wanted to be a student of Imam Sadiq. Okay? It's a very famous story. I'm sure all of you have heard this before. But very, very quickly, I'm trying to get to that last point. Anyways, he approaches our sixth Imam several times. Can you please be my teacher? Please be my teacher. He says, look, you have Malik. You're good. You're okay there. Turns to Allah now. Unwan al-Basri begs Allah, please soften the heart of Imam Sadiq towards me, continues to ask him whenever he can. He ends up, this man at the door of Imam Sadiq, sitting on the ground in front of his door. Keep that picture in your mind. Sitting on the ground in Medina in front of the door of Imam Sadiq. When Imam Sadiq sees this, he brings him inside. Come. And then he tells him this beautiful hadith that I would recommend my youth to look up. Unwan Basri. UNWAN Basri. It's there, beautifully translated, laid out in English online. The beauty to me of this story is Unwan Basri was 94 years old. Now, a 94-year-old man sitting on the ground in Medina, on the ground in front of Imam Sadiq. Are you okay? Everything all right? But this is the commitment he had to the path of knowledge. How do I show Imam Sadiq how absolutely obsessed I am that I want my path of knowledge to travel through you? 94 years old. There's no retirement age when it comes to knowledge of Islam. My elders... No, it has to be even incremental, bit by bit. If there's a little bit of izafe and an addition to your knowledge, alhamdulillah. Now, in the same hadith of Unwan al-Basri, Imam Sadiq has a beautiful journey of knowledge. He says, ilm is not knowledge. That's just English's weak translation. He says, ilm is a journey, he says. Ilm is a journey. That starts with information in your brain, ma'alumat, descends onto the hearts. Now Shabir Bhai and I had a beautiful conversation last night for about 2 seconds. He says, tell them, Sayyid, about the softness of the heart. Tell these young guys they need a heart. Yes. Ilm does not stay up here in Islam. It's not just facts that you are regurgitating. True ilm is captured by the hearts. From the heart now, it travels towards amal. Understand that journey. We know a lot. It's all up here, right? Do the calculation, my elders. How many thousands of hours of majas of Imam Hussein have you heard? Way back to when you were a beautiful, tall, good-looking jawan. Way back when. It's been, what, 30 years, 40 years? 30 years, 40 years? How many hours? And even in a 45-minute lecture, if there was 50 minutes of knowledge of that, as Ayatollah Bahajat says, Rahmatullah alayh, if us, the Shia nation, simply acted on what we knew already, we'd be somewhere else right now. So it's up here. But the way that hadith says, it's like clouds. Clouds are here. But the clouds, what, begin to move, they begin to evaporate, they're gone after a while. Some days are cloudy, some days are, there's not a single cloud in the sky. They grab that cloud and begin to, what, absorb it through the heart. Has to go through the heart. Once the heart captures it, that's it. I'm sold, now I'm going to begin to act on it. So ilm becomes amal, the lam and meem, just switch spots, that's it. But that's the kamal of ilm, and it's very difficult, it's a very humbling process. It's also a very meticulous process. In an instant gratifying society, Islam says, don't adopt that when it comes to knowledge. If you apply one thing your whole life, that's successful. If your whole life, all you're trying to do is wake up for Fajr, please. I'm 64 years old, 71 years old. I still sleep through my alarm. And you're struggling, you put the alarm there, you put one in the bathroom. Ayatul Kursi, says Surah Kaf, you name it, you've asked 1,000 times. You really are struggling. Now God sees that struggle. The humbleness is very, very important. We have to approach knowledge with the amount of humbleness. I talked about that tartib, right? The idea of Surah Jum'ah, that, look, it's a relation of the signs, where you zakihim, where you allimuhum al-kitab. But the reason why we sent, he was mab'uth onto those who are the ummiyin, the people of Mecca, the Prophet of Allah, yaktu alayhim ayati, tell them the signs, purify them, and then teach them. Purify them, and then teach them. Let the heart be ready to embrace the knowledge. Otherwise, that knowledge feeds the ego.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. this program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Britain's Supreme Court on Wednesday, 23rd of November, rejected a bid by the devolved Scottish Government in Edinburgh to hold a new referendum on Scottish independence without the consent of London. We'll take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. France 24, France 24, has covered this story and gives us more details. Britain's highest court on Wednesday, 23rd of November, rejected a bid by the devolved Scottish Government in Edinburgh to hold a new referendum on independence without London's consent. The unanimous ruling by the Supreme Court torpedoed the Scottish Nationalist Government's push to hold a second referendum next year. The Scottish National Party, the SNP, had said that in that event it would turn the next general election into a de facto vote on splitting from the rest of the United Kingdom, threatening constitutional chaos. Scotland's First Minister and SNP leader Nicola Sturgeon said she respected the ruling but was disappointed. "If Scotland cannot choose our own future without Westminster's consent, the idea of the United Kingdom as a voluntary partnership was exposed as a myth," Nicola Sturgeon tweeted. Sturgeon tweeted, "While disappointed by it, I respect the ruling of the UK Supreme Court. It doesn't make law, only interprets it. A law that doesn't allow Scotland to choose our own future without Westminster consent exposes as myth any notion of the UK as a voluntary partnership and makes the case for independence." The Supreme Court's Scottish President, Robert Reid, said the power to call a referendum was reserved to the UK Parliament under Scotland's devolution settlement. Therefore, the Scottish Parliament does not have the power to legislate for a referendum on Scottish independence Robert Reed said. Nicola Sturgeon's SNP-led government in Edinburgh wanted to hold a vote in October of next year on the question, should Scotland be an independent country? The British government, which oversees constitutional affairs for the whole country, has repeatedly refused to give Edinburgh the power to hold a second referendum. It considers that the last one, in 2014, when 55% of Scots rejected independence, settled the question for at least a generation. But Nicola Sturgeon and her party say there is now an indisputable mandate for another independence referendum, particularly in the light of Britain's departure from the European Union. Most voters in Scotland opposed Brexit. Scotland's last parliamentary election returned a majority of pro-independence lawmakers for the first time. At a hearing in the UK Supreme Court last month, lawyers for the government in London argued that the Scottish government could not decide to hold a referendum on its own. Permission had to be granted because the constitutional makeup of the four nations of the United Kingdom was a reserved matter for the government in London. Lawyers for the Scottish government wanted a ruling on the rights of the devolved parliament in Edinburgh if London continued to block an independence referendum. Lord Advocate Dorothy Bain, Scotland's top law officer, said Scottish independence was a live and significant issue in Scottish politics. The Scottish government was seeking to create its own legal framework for another referendum, arguing that the right to self-determination is a fundamental and inalienable right. But the UK Supreme Court rejected international comparisons raised by the Scottish Nationalist Party SNP, which had likened Scotland to Quebec in Canada or to Kosovo. Reid said international law on self-determination only applied to former colonies, or where a people is oppressed by military occupation, or when a defined group is denied its political and civil rights. None of that applies to Scotland, the UK Supreme Court president said. Robert Reid also rejected the SNP's argument that a referendum would only be advisory and not legally binding. Any such vote would carry practical political consequences regardless of its legal status, the judge ruled. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Scottish government cannot hold a second referendum on independence without approval from the British Parliament. The United Kingdom's top court ruled on Wednesday, 23rd of November, dealing a blow to nationalists' hopes of holding a vote next year. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, leader of the pro-independence Scottish National Party, the SNP, had announced earlier this year she intended to hold an advisory vote on secession next October, but that it had to be lawful and internationally recognised. After the UK Supreme Court ruled she could not do so without the approval of the United Kingdom Parliament, she repeated her vow to campaign in the next UK-wide election, expected to be held in 2024, solely on a platform of whether Scotland should be independent, making it a de facto referendum. We must and we will find another democratic, lawful and constitutional means by which the Scottish people can express their will. In my view, that can only be an election, Nicola Sturgeon told reporters. She added, as of today, democracy is what is at stake. It is now about whether or not we even have the basic democratic right to choose our own future, she said. In a referendum in 2014, the people of Scotland rejected ending the more than 300-year-old union with England by 55% to 45%. But nationalists argued that the vote for Brexit just 2 years later, which the majority of Scottish voters opposed, changed everything. However, the British government in London has repeatedly said it would not grant permission for another referendum, saying it should be a once-in-a-generation event. In a unanimous verdict of 5 judges, the Supreme Court ruled the Scottish Government could not pass legislation paving the way for an advisory second referendum without the approval of Britain's Parliament. We respect the clear and definitive ruling of the Supreme Court, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said. Rishi Sunak added, I think that the people of Scotland want us to be working on fixing the major challenges that we collectively face, whether that's the economy, supporting the National Health Service, or indeed supporting Ukraine. Now is the time for politicians to work together.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. The United States also played an obvious role in the recent riots that took place in our country in the past few weeks. This is their plan. This is their intention. However, the Iranian nation punched them in the mouth, and it will continue to punch them in the mouth after this. The ones we are really concerned about are those who devised these schemes and entered the scene of action with intention, plans, and knowledge. They were connected to foreign agencies. They committed a crime. The incident that happened in Shah Cheragh Shrine in Shiraz was a great crime. What did these boys in the second grade or the sixth grade or the 10th grade do to deserve this? The poor 6-year-old boy who lost his father, his mother, and his brother in the criminal act, why did they weigh him down with so much grief? Why? How is this child going to bear this immense amount of unbearable grief? These are crimes. They are great crimes.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The young, pious, and religious students, our dear Arman, who was martyred while being tortured, and his lifeless body was abandoned on the streets of Tehran. What did he do to deserve this? Are these minor things? Who are these people? We need to think about it. Who are the people doing this? They are not our children. They are not our youth. Who are they? Who is giving them orders? Why haven't the so-called supporters of human rights condemned them? Why have they not condemned the Shiraz incident? Why do they repeat a false claim thousands of times on their platforms on the internet, yet ban the name of Arsham, one of the child victims of the terrorist attack? Why? Are these so-called supporters real supporters of human rights? That is what they are like. We need to recognize these. We need to recognize them. Of course, we will not let them get away with this. The Islamic Republic will definitely make these criminals pay.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.